Underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester, Vermont, and Saratoga, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a master's degree in English with a concentration in literature studies and an MFA in creative writing. strose.edu/gradprograms.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. B.A. Shapiro brilliantly captured the world of art theft and forgery in her critically acclaimed best-selling novel, The Art Forger. Shapiro's latest is The Muralist, a story about the birth of abstract expressionism, set against the backdrop of the Depression and the eve of World War II. The Muralist plunges readers into pre-war politics and captures both the inner workings of New York's art scene and the beginnings of the American school of abstract expressionism. B.A. Shapiro has taught sociology at Tufts University and creative writing at Northwestern. Again, the new novel is The Muralist, and it's a great pleasure to welcome B.A. Shapiro to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us.
It's my pleasure, too.
What brought you to this subject? And I guess the first part of the question is, what ultimately did you want to grasp in this book that perhaps was left over from the last book?
Well, one of the things I wanted to do was write about art again. I had such a great time with it, with The Art Forger, and people seemed to really like it, so I thought I would do it again. And I had always wanted to write about the Depression. My parents had grown up during that era and had always been fascinated by the deprivations and how those deprivations had influenced them even well into adulthood. And so I started doing a little research, and I came up with, when you put the Depression and art together, you come up with the WPA, Roosevelt's New Deal program to put the country back to work, because they hired artists the same way they hired plumbers and carpenters, and they paid them a living wage to create art. And I thought this was a very good, interesting subject. And then I discovered that Jackson Pollock, Lee Krasner, Mark Rothko, and a lot of other well-known artists were all in New York City at the time doing working for the WPA and creating, as you mentioned, the School of Abstract Expressionism. And I thought, oh, these people are really interesting. Maybe I'll make them actual characters in the book. And then when I discovered that Eleanor Roosevelt had been instrumental in convincing Franklin to include artists in the WPA, and she's one of my favorite people ever, I thought, cool, okay, I'll make her a character too. And when I discovered that the greatest regret at the end of her life was that she was unable to convince Franklin to help more of the refugees, I knew I had a book.
When it comes to the actual telling of the story, you start in present day and then go backwards.
Yes.
Why that choice, and what did you want to start out and have the story begin in current time?
Well, one of the things I wanted to play around with was this idea that whatever moment in time you're born has an effect on you. We talk about nature and nurture, but this is aside from those two things, and how for the protagonist is a young woman who's a struggling artist in 1939 in the past, and the protagonist in the present is a young artist struggling in 2015, and how different were their lives and their life chances, and how was their art and their personalities and pretty much everything they did affected by the moment in time that they were living.
Tell us about each protagonist, and beginning with Danielle, who is in the present day.
Well, Danielle is an artist who has given up her art out of frustration, and she's now working as a cataloger at Christie's. I didn't know this. It's really interesting when you do research, but anybody can find a painting in their grandmother's attic and bring it to Sotheby's or Christie's, and they will check it out and see if it has any value. So Danielle is working as the front level person called a cataloger, and a box shows up on her desk. And this box, it turns out, another interesting piece, a piece of information that I found out, is that so the WPA had an aspect that WPA hired muralists and graphics people and sculptors and painters. And there was a group of people in what they called the Easel Project. And they created paintings and brought them in at the end of the month. And then they were given their paychecks and they went back. So the WPA had a warehouse full of these paintings, which they then hung in the buildings that they were building. But when World War II started and the program was closed down quickly, they didn't know what to do with these paintings, so they left them out on the street as trash. Now, of course, they didn't know that they had Rothko, Pollock, and Krasners in this group. But when Danielle goes to her office, on the first page of the book, she discovers a cardboard box. And the rumor is that it was WPA paintings. And she believes that there are Krasners, Rothkos, and Pollocks in there. When she turns these paintings around, she discovers vellum envelopes which hold pieces of another painting. And so she is inspired to find out who painted these paintings. Are these really Rothkos, Krasners, and Pollocks? And could the person who painted the paintings actually be her missing great aunt?
And the missing great aunt is a mysterious figure and also the protagonist that we go to in Back in Time.
Right. And her name is Alizée Benoit, and she is an artist working for the WPA, painting murals in a warehouse in New York City. And her best friend is Lee Krasner, who paints murals alongside of her. She goes to the Jumble Shop, which is a real place, and hangs out with all the artists of that era, Jackson Pollock and Willem de Kooning and Gorky and Hans Hoffman, and especially Mark Rothko, who is her lover. She is befriended by Eleanor Roosevelt, who comes to her warehouse and is taken by Alizée when Alizée asks her why there aren't any abstract murals that the WPA is supporting. And then Eleanor becomes her patron. And when Alizée receives a letter from her family in France, she lost her parents and was raised by her French family, who are now in German-occupied France, and they need visas. And Alizée is having a lot of trouble coming up with them because of staunch isolationists such as Charles Lindbergh and Joe Kennedy and the very, very evil Breckinridge Long. She and Eleanor tried to get the visas. Both of them are frustrated in this. And Alizée then makes some decisions and does some questionable acts. And then she mysteriously disappears.
Alizée is a beautiful name. Where did that come from? How much did you know about it prior to starting the novel?
Names are very important. And they have to sound right to me. They also have to come from, like, my name is Barbara. There are no Barbaras who are 15 years old. And so you have to match the name. You know, how many Kimberleys are there that are, you know, 60 years old? There aren't. So you have to match the name. She was French, so I wanted something French. And so I went online and I put in French girls' names popular in 1925, which was when she was born, and got a list of them. And I just went through them and wrote down the ones that I liked the best until finally Alizée sounded the best to me. And now, of course, what other name could she have? It's like naming your child. It's the only name she could be.
B.A. Shapiro is our guest. The name of the new novel is The Muralist. It is published by Algonquin. This is a novel that is a lot about moral failings, isn't it? Not just art, but moral failings.
Correct.
What brought you to that? Did that come naturally as part of the process, or was that something in your mind at the beginning?
Well, I like characters who, like real people, are flawed. And we all have our good sides and our bad sides. And the whole question of morality, which also was an issue in The Art Forger, has always fascinated me. Again, it's a historical moment, what's moral at one time and not at another. I think that it really started when I discovered about Breckinridge Long, who I had never heard of and most of the people I talked to have never heard of. He was Assistant Secretary of State under Franklin Roosevelt. They had been friends for many, many years, and Franklin is well known to have to be extremely loyal. And he was in charge of allocating visas, visas that had already been approved by Congress, and two refugees in Europe who were running from Hitler who had already been vetted. And he was just in charge of getting the visas to the people and getting them into the country. And we now know that he was single-handedly responsible for keeping 200,000 vetted refugees from valid visas just because he was an isolationist and a huge anti-Semite. And this moral failing of his then brought into question greater moral failings on the part of government. And then what Alizée did when she was forced to confront his evilness and in direct relationship to helping her family get to this country and helping other refugees get to this country. And we all do good and bad things. And one at one moment is acceptable and it isn't acceptable at another moment.
So there is that tragic element to the novel in the timelessness as obviously we face a new refugee crisis.
Well, it's interesting. When I was writing the novel, I was focused on, and again, this goes back to the two going back and forth in time, the idea that we cannot help ourselves from waging war, from distrusting and often hating the other, and that this is just something that we do over and over and over again. I finished the book about a year and a half ago, so it was well before the present refugee crisis. But the refugee crisis is a result of war. We had Hitler and all of his crazy people trying to make the world in the image of what he wanted. And now we have ISIS and all these other crazy people trying to make the world in the image of what they want. And there are all of these innocent people who are caught in, you know, this madness and need to run from their homes for their own safety. And no one is willing to take them in because they are the other.
I am fascinated in your writing about Mark Rothko. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that you do inevitably as a reader of a novel like this is, well, how much of this is really about Mark? How much of this is true about Mark Rothko? How much is fiction? How much is true? And I guess it's safe to say what we do know is that he was very unstable.
Right. This whole issue of creativity and artistic genius, whether we're talking about artists or writers or musicians or, as it turns out, politicians, there is a strong correlation. It's not causality, but it's a correlation between people who are writers, artists, politicians and musicians, and the propensity to develop mental illness, particularly bipolar disorder. Mark Rothko was bipolar, but probably Jackson Pollock was also. Mark Rothko did commit suicide, as did many other of these great artists. It's questionable whether Jackson Pollock committed suicide, but one might say getting really drunk and driving a car 90 miles an hour into a tree could be conceived as suicide. And this whole issue of creativity and mental illness is just fascinating.
When it comes to the forces meeting one another and your fictional creations and these real artists, so you get to play with them for a while. I mean, that mm-hmm. seems really luring.
It's people always ask me, you know, can I get sued for doing this? you can get sued for anything, so... But what I tried to do is I did a lot of research on each of these characters, from Eleanor Roosevelt to Breckinridge Long to Mark Rothko to Jackson Pollock. And what I tried to do and hope I did is everything that they do or think in the book is something that they could have done or thought or said. given what I know about them and their personalities. Some people, particularly the political people in the book, actually speak words that they did really speak.
In the novel, Alize is attempting to bring awareness to the plight of European refugees and to diffuse anti-Semitic politics in the United States through her art. Who would her contemporary have been in real life?
Well, Picasso, and I discuss his painting Guernica, and Alize sees it, and she bases her painting on this. And this was an anti-war painting that he had done. And she struggles with many of her friends who feel that it isn't appropriate for politics and art to mix. But she feels very strongly that art can affect people on an emotional level and then hopefully change their mind. And that's what she's really trying to do.
And this is also, of course, a story about sacrifice.
Yes. And what are we willing to sacrifice for what is important to us?
What is important for us and what is important for our art?
For our art and for other people, for our families, mm-hmm. you know, for our group. And what's right? What is right? What is morally correct here?
Do you have to have a pretty good grasp of that going in, or do you like to wrestle with those questions as you're writing?
I pretty much wrestle with them as I'm writing. What I like to know going in is more the plot. I need to know that there's a beginning and a middle and an end before I have the guts to actually start writing. And I find that the themes seem to emerge from the development of the plot and the characters, and that often it's not until a third, fourth, or fifth draft. I do many, many drafts. I'd say every page of this book has been rewritten at least 20 times. The themes emerge, and that's where I start to play with them and have them blend with each other and support each other a little bit more.
B.A. Shapiro is our guest on this week's book show. The novel is The Muralist. It is published by Algonquin. Let's go back and talk a little bit about Danielle, who is trying to find out what happened to her great aunt. She is trying to find out what led to her mysterious disappearance. And there is a sense that she's fighting the clock too, isn't she?
Yes, she is struggling the same way Alize was struggling with art and her place in the art world and her talent and her possibilities. And in Danielle's journey to discover what happened to Alize, she also starts to discover things about herself, her own artwork, and the power of great art over time.
What were your takeaways when it comes to abstract expressionism and the artists who were creating it during this time?
Well, it's really interesting. A lot of people will look at a Jackson Pollock or a Mark Rothko and say, I could do that, or my five-year-old could do that. But through the process of studying about these artists and what they were trying to do and how they were using non-representational means, color and shape and the juxtaposition of these things to get at emotions. And if you sit and spend time looking, really, really looking at a Pollock or a Rothko, you realize the depth of the colors, the composition, and you start to feel emotion about it. They can make you happy. They can make you sad. They can make you wonder about things as you stare into their depths. So I learned a lot about appreciating abstract art, and particularly the abstract expressionists.
You talked about the Jumble Shop. Give us a sense of that place and the incubator that it was for the art that came out of it.
It was just amazing. You know, if it had not been for the WPA, for the government actually sponsoring artwork, It never would have happened. So the Jumble Shop was a bar, and they served a little bit of food, and they also had art shows there. And so that drew a lot of artists there. They would have the artists put their art up around the shop. And sometimes people would buy it. Most of the time they didn't. And there was a huge group of artists that went there. And they hung out. And there was this incredible cross-fertilization of ideas. And it turns out that abstract expressionism is considered the first great American school of art because it was exported to Europe rather than what had happened with every other school of art, which was that we imported it from Europe. So this mix of artists it was just this great pot. And it's interesting that the government did support these artists who created the first American school of art.
At the end of the book, you do write that the degree of anti-Semitism in this country in the 30s and 40s is also commonly underestimated. How so?
Right. Well, for example, I use this example in the book. We're talking 1939, and there were restaurants in New York City with big signs that said no Negroes and no Jews, and people just walked by. You know, when we talk about, you know, what's right at one moment in time and right at another moment of time, here is something that everybody just accepted. And I asked my mother, I'm Jewish, how she felt about it. And she said, well, we didn't want to go anywhere that people didn't want us to be. So we went other places. Completely different way of thinking about things.
You bring it out in the novel as though that is, as it was, commonplace. And how do you let the reader know that indeed was commonplace? I guess I ask you the question because you felt compelled to put it in the afterword.
I have the carrot. It's very difficult when you write historical fiction because I know that the reader is bringing their 2015 sensibilities to this. Like, for example, when I use that example in the book, I hesitated over using the word Negro, which is not the correct word that we would use now. We would say black. But Negro is what it said on the signs, and so I left it like that. And we have trouble stepping out of our own moment in time. And so I had the characters interacting like this with these signs, but I wanted in the author's note at the end to make it clear that this was not fiction, that this was something that had actually happened. I did it also in the author's note. Eleanor Roosevelt is the First Lady. First ladies now cannot live normal lives at all. They're totally protected. Right. But at that time, she was a lot freer to come and go than anybody is now. And I thought it was important to bring that out because to our sensibilities now, it doesn't seem like it would have been possible.
Will you write about art again?
I'm actually writing about art again. When we tried to sell The Art Forger originally, it got turned down by every major publisher in New York because they said it didn't fit into a genre because it had art and romance and history and mystery. And so The Muralist also has all of these elements. And the third book that I'm writing takes place, it's about art, about the post-impressionists and early modernists. It takes place in Paris and Philadelphia in the 1920s, and they're all hanging out in Gertrude Stein's salon with Hemingway and Fitzgerald. And there's a potential murder, and lots of con men and con women in it, and lots of cons. And my protagonist is having an affair with Henri Matisse. So I think I'm creating my own genre here of non-genre.
Well, a lot of good ingredients. Stir, mix, and enjoy, I assume.
Thank you.
Well, B.A. Shapiro's new novel is The Muralist. It is published by Algonquin. Thank you very much for being with us. What a great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thanks so much. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue. The Blue.
it speaks so full, it's like the beauty one can barely stand. Or too much things dropped in your head. And there's a grief like the peace in your heart sometimes, painted underneath the sheets of ashy snow. And there's a blue like where the urban angels go, very bright. Now the Calder Mobile tips a biomorphic sphere. Then it swings its dangling pieces round to other paintings.